As I mentioned, Samuel Lewis, you know, so here's a man raised as a Jew, born in America, studying Zen and Sufism, studying them basically for about 50 years, and then initiated as a teacher in both. In addition, he continued to be interested in Kabbalah. In fact, it was his interest in Kabbalah that led to his family disowning him, if you can imagine. And they literally did disown him, and that even though he graduated very high up in his secondary school education, they threw him out of the house and refused to send him to university, which is almost unheard of in a Jewish household in the United States towards the, you could say, 1920s, 1930s. Samuel Lewis also studied Hinduism, but in Bhakti Hinduism, through a man by the name of Swami Papa Ramdas. And he was also involved, interestingly enough, in co-forming a Christian mystical order in San Francisco with a man by the name of Father Paul Blyton, called the Holy Order of Mans, M-A-E-N-S, which is not, was not referring to the masculine, but was a Greek term. So he was pretty much a, you could say, polyglot esotericist in America. Towards the end of his life, he had an idea that there could be a way to bring people together with spirituality, with spiritual practice. Even though it seemed as though individual spiritualities and religions all had their own practice, there might be a way to bring people together. And this is, as I mentioned the other night, was his program, which he called Dances of Universal Peace. It was part of a larger plan that he had, which he called Eat, Dance, and Pray Together. So he actually felt that spirituality could be a means of bringing people together. If you brought people together, sharing spiritual practice, dancing together, sharing sacred phrases from different traditions, it would lower the level of superstition about, you could say, the other religions, other practices. And it would be a doorway for people who were inclined to enter, you know, authentic streams of Hinduism, Buddhism, Sufism, Zen, Christian mysticism, by celebrating all these in one circle. So it was not another form of religion. It was simply, you could say, it was a practice without a theology, without a philosophy, without a dogma attached to it. It was 100% practice with nothing that you had to subscribe to or believe. And this has essentially been the way that the Dances of Universal Peace have continued since Samuel Lewis's passing in 1971. So in many countries of the world, there are small groups still meeting doing these practices in open groups, including here at Edinburgh. Samuel Lewis also, and I want to mention this in connection with the dances, as I think really from his Sufi tradition, he develops this idea of barakah. Barakah means blessing in the Sufi tradition. And it means that when one does one's practices, one is not only doing them for him or herself, but is doing them as a blessing for the space or for one's community. And some of you, if you know Buddhism, you can see a connection here between Mahayana Buddhism, which is also service-oriented, compassion-oriented, and Sufism. The same concepts you find in Mahayana Buddhism is that one is not doing practices solely for one's own enlightenment, but one does them for the benefit of all sentient beings. And Samuel Lewis's Zen was a Mahayana, you know, Mahayana practice, so he brings this in. But his notion of doing spiritual practice as a blessing for this, you could say, for space, for community, for healing places where, you could say, great tragedies have occurred. For instance, some of the practices of the dances or of Samuel Lewis have been done in concentration camps, for instance, in Germany, have been done recently, are being done. Other places, I know some Americans that are doing some of these practices. They've done them on some of the where some of the very gruesome battles of the American Civil War occurred, these practices. So the notion of blessing the earth comes into the practices and is part of the Dances of Universal Peace. Samuel Lewis was also, he's again, as I say, sort of he's a wild figure. This is one view of just part of him. but he was, as he called himself, almost a super intellectual, as well as had a great interest in spiritual practice. So he also, in his spare time, wrote epic poetry, if you can imagine, in the style of Walt Whitman, who was, you could say, a transcendental poet of the of the United States. And in 1938, just on the eve of the Second World War, Samuel Lewis wrote some epic poetry. He says it was as though he were visited by the spirits, you could say, or by the prophets of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And part of this is as though it was almost dictated to him, you could say. In modern parlance, he felt some of this was channeled from other sources. But albeit that it appears in the form of very Whitman-esque, almost, if you know William Blake, it's a similar poetic form to what William Blake uses. And Samuel Lewis wrote about a vision of the Holy Land in 1938, again, even before the establishment of the State of Israel. In one of the three long poems in this book, which is called Jerusalem Trilogy, he wrote a poem called The Day of the Lord Cometh, which is taken from the Hebrew scripture. And he saw basically large forces at work in the world at that time, pre-World War II. The large forces that he saw in the world were the forces of capitalism, which he calls mammon, which is a word Jesus uses. Actually, it's an Aramaic word, which just means heaping up stuff, which is actually a good description of Western consumer culture. The forces of mammon, the forces of Marxism, that is, of communism, and also what he would call the forces of unity, of sacred unity, the three religions of the book coming together to offer a sense of divine, you could say, of restoring existence to its sacred quality. I would call it restoring a cosmology, a sacred cosmology, that the earth is sacred, our relationship with each other is sacred, and we all share the same reality. So he saw these as possible forces. He saw advantages, you know, to the individualism in which capitalism was pursuing itself. It allowed people to develop themselves, to develop their creativity, but also he recognized, you know, the downside of capitalism. He saw the positive sides of, you could say, Marxism, communism, as, you could say, sharing, more egalitarian, less differences between rich and poor. But he saw the downside of Marxism being that it had no sense of sacredness. It didn't have a sacred cosmology. It tended to be overly materialistic in a different way. So he wrote, I'm just going to read you a little bit of this poem, because again, it's in a strange, you may find it as a strange form of English, but perhaps not. Again, it's not much different from, as I say, Blake. So he wrote, and again, he's specifically focusing this part of the poem on, again, this is before, you have to understand, this is before the founding of the State of Israel. But he sees that the Holy Land, this whole area, which was, again, there were discussions about forming a state of Israel, but it hadn't actually happened. So he's speaking of Israel not in its political sense, but in its larger, you could say, symbolic significance. Our friend Sheikh Abul Qasim spoke of this last night, for those of you that were here. You know, you restore the spiritual meaning to the word Israel, which would mean to see unity, and then also this, he says, there's a spiritual derivation of the word Palestine also, again, not referring to political boundaries, but to restore this area of the Holy Land as really the center point for peace that he was proposing. And Samuel Lewis had a very similar vision again in 1938, which he writes this: "The unity of Israel shall not come by race, neither shall it arise from concordance of worship," that is, everyone has to worship the same religion. "But the one that sees the Spirit of God shall be known as Israel." That's literal, the literal derivation of the word from Hebrew. Yisrael means to see, ra-el, to see unity. "The one who sees the Spirit of God shall be known as Israel. And the one that follows the law of God shall be called Jacob." Again, a derivation of that. "There shall be peace in the world when there is peace in Zion. There shall be peace in Zion when the power of mammon is no more. There shall be satisfaction in Zion when the shackles of Marx are removed. Universality is not enough. Till there is universality in the mind, in the heart, in the spirit. For thou shalt love universality with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might." And again, as I said, this particular poem is as though he says he's speaking with the voice of Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah. "Then I, Jeremiah, beheld a vision. For the Lord, the Eternal, blessed be He, blessed be She, vouchsafed unto me a vision. Even while I sat in contemplation did this vision come. There was a vision of Jerusalem anew. Not a new Jerusalem of the heavens, but Jerusalem on earth. Even the self-same Jerusalem that has always been. In the heart of this Jerusalem was a temple, and the city of Jerusalem was about this temple, and the streets of Jerusalem led to this temple. To this temple came all peoples to worship. The people of Israel came on the seventh day. The people of Ishmael came on the sixth day. The people of Edom came on the first day. Again, in his parlance, and also in the wider traditions of the book, the people of Edom, Edom is symbolic for the Christians. Indirectly, Edom in the old biblical stories, which I don't want to describe right now, ends up being the Christians in this sort of symbology that is used by Muslims and Jews alike. So each person, each group coming on their own sacred day. And then he quotes from the prophets. For from the rising of the sun even unto the going down of the same, my name is great among the nations. And in every place offerings are presented unto my name, even pure oblations. For my name is great amongst the nations, said the Lord of hosts. That's from the book of Malachi. No longer were there fisticuffs in holy places, very polite English term. No longer did sect strive with sect, cult with cult, but selected people of Jacob did guard the temple. No more was there worship, except in humility. Nor were pilgrims robbed, nor did innkeepers exploit them, nor were pretended relics sold at any price. There the exiles of Israel led in humility. They did not lead in worship, they did not lead in argument, they did not lead in ostentation. In humility alone did they lead, as Moses had before them. No longer did Ishmael turn upon Israel, nor the sons of Edom upon one another in holy places. For the guardian of Israel was the guardian of the temple, and the holy days of Israel were celebrated in the temple. And when the temple was not used by the men of Jacob, the other peoples had access to the holy place. For the law of the Lord was for Ishmael and Edom, the teachings of the Lord were for Israel and Jacob. And he goes on a bit like this, again, sort of in this visionary sense. I mentioned this morning, briefly in the talk this morning, that there would be, in the most holy places, especially in the Middle East, there would be shared shrines. You know, we heard Eliyahu describe this morning, that there are already some shared shrines in the Middle East, although the sharing is sometimes like one side divided by a wall is Jewish, the other side is Islamic, or one floor is Jewish, the other is Islamic. This is a start. Samuel Lewis had a vision that actually all of the holy places, especially sacred to the peoples of the book, would be open to all peoples, and then under guardianship that would make them safe and secure, so that the followers, you could say the devotees of these traditions could honor and worship in peace. And he felt that this would be like the old medieval cities of refuge, that once you established the cities of refuge, these would be safe places where people could go when they were in trouble or if they needed refuge. And then his next idea was that you would build the roads between these safe places, these holy places, would also be secured, and a sort of network of peace and prayer would be established throughout the Middle East, and that this would build a sort of basis for peace on the ground. Of course, now, at this stage, it seems rather ambitious. But actually, some of it, I think, is actually still quite practical. And more, as we see even in the news, the issue of establishing safety at places of shrine, at places of pilgrimage, is very much at the heart of the concerns of people of the Middle East, no matter what their particular persuasion. He felt, coming back to the idea of dances of universal peace, that it behooved those of us who lived in the West, who did not live in the Middle East, to prepare the ground, you could say prepare the earth in our own hearts, find the Middle East within ourselves where we have these warring voices within us, and begin to, you know, solve our own problems so that we're not a burden on other peoples. And as some of you know from the long history of European and American intervention in the Middle East, we have in general, while perhaps not with the best of intentions, caused more problems than we've solved in the Middle East, starting with, of course, the aftermath of the First World War, and on, and simply on from there. But he felt that working with any sort of spiritual practice where people were able to come together in peace, whether it's dances of universal peace or Vipassana or any sort of multi-faith spiritual practice, would be a way of establishing in our own hearts this sort of peace. And so that was this, you say, the brief background of those practices. I began in my own involvement with the dances of universal peace in 1976. And was involved with some of the original uses of the dances in citizen diplomacy between the United States, Europe, and the Soviet Union. And this took the form of somewhat traditional citizen diplomacy at that time, where we took groups over to meet Russian partners. But instead of just meeting and talking with them, we felt that it would be good to join a circle with our friends and actually dance with them. So in addition to the planned meetings, we also appeared in public in the Soviet Union in unplanned public places, formed a circle and began to hand out cards to people in Russian. It's a bit proselytizing, but it was saying, we're going to dance for peace between our countries. Wouldn't you please join us? And this was a bit risky at the time during the Soviet Union days, but we did do this, and we connected with various partners unofficially at that time. You have to understand that in the old Soviet Union days, public gatherings and public gathering places were tightly controlled by the Soviet Union. Hotels did not have even large lobbies where you could meet with groups. So we had to, in general, meet sometimes in secret, sometimes openly in secret, doing something crazy, something that would be ignored, like spiritual dance, so that we weren't noticed. And over that, doing this over a number of different years, we formed partnership with the Soviet Union and with many other groups that did citizen diplomacy. I really feel that these sorts of informal measures helped lower the atmosphere of tension amongst, you could say, everyday folks. Everyday people were less inclined to demonize Russians or Soviets as the big enemy, the big Satan, as Reagan once called them. Because they knew Russians, they had met Russians, they had danced with Russians, they had eaten, with them. And this, you could say, history of citizen diplomacy, I think, is really largely unrecognized in the way that it helped to bring down the so-called Cold War. Yes, there were economic and political situations, but in many cases, particularly in the case of the U.S., citizen opinion had reached the point where it could no longer be successfully carried on. Of course, from the Russian, if you say from the Soviet point of view, that where there were economic considerations, but also Gorbachev, if you read the writings of Gorbachev, who's almost forgotten now, they are actually very visionary, I find, and very wise, and very spiritual, actually, unusually enough to say, and I would still maintain that. We've tried some of this approach in the Middle East as well. It's more conflicted in the Middle East when you start to chant sacred phrases in public, but it is possible. As I mentioned the other night, we went in 1993 and some subsequent visits then. Particularly in 1993, the timing was good because we timed our trip, although we didn't know it then, but we arrived in September 1993 towards the end. And this was actually, as we landed, it was revealed in the newspaper that these initial Oslo Accords were going to be signed. And that they were kept under wraps. They were kept secret beforehand. So we had a similar plan mapped out, which is some of us are experienced in the anti-war movement, anti-Vietnam War movement in the U.S. And so we knew a little bit about organizing demonstrations and safe demonstrations. So we had sort of people watching for safety around as we formed circles. And then we did the same in Jewish areas. We handed out cards in Hebrew describing what we were doing. In Islamic areas, we handed out cards in Hebrew describing what we were doing and invited people to join us. And the strategy we came up with at the time was to begin chanting neither in Hebrew or in Arabic, but in Aramaic, for reasons that I mentioned this afternoon, because the Hebrew speakers thought that Aramaic sounded enough like Hebrew that they had nothing against it, and the Arabic speakers thought it sounded enough like Arabic that they had nothing against it, and so they joined in. And then we proceeded to share chants and share dances from the three traditions. It was variously successful, I would say. It was certainly successful during the September time. And so some of this is continuing with the work of Eliyahu, and you know, he also has a friend that he brought last year, Ibrahim, and also Sheikh Aziz, Abdul Aziz, this year. These are methods that are used to bring people together. So if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them. This lady right in front of you, in the blue, leads Dances of Universal Peace in Edinburgh in two places. One is the Friends Meeting House, and the other, I believe, is still Salisbury Center? No, it's at St. George's West. Yeah. So see her for that. And yeah, there's a fairly large network of the Dances of Universal Peace in the UK, which is at Dances of .org.uk, Dances of Universal Peace .org.uk. Yes, you'll find out what's going on with that. So, yep, and fairly large movement in other areas of Europe too. Germany, particularly, has a very large dance network. The US, of course, quite large. Australia, New Zealand is very active. Russia is also. Russia, Czech Republic, Poland a bit, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. We have one of our Estonian Dances of Universal Peace teachers here as well. Sitting right here. Anything else? Yes. Yes, I remember this.
So, I think that was a very, it appears that in these 20 years, things haven't quite changed.
Well, perhaps not just the 20 years, but, you know, some human tendencies continue even from the times when the prophets were around, when these first stories were told. As I was saying this morning, if you look in some of the stories that were told, the same sort of human frailties are brought up even in the creation stories that we're still living through. How to balance diversity with community. I mean, these are stories, these are questions that I believe really arise much, much earlier, even before there were any religious or spiritual traditions of humanity, but perhaps arise from the time when we ceased being nomadic on this planet and started to settle in settled communities. Because it's at this time, about 10,000 years BCE, that the first, all the great creation stories and myths start to appear around the planet. Perhaps the native Aboriginal tradition is earlier, that is, the Australian Aboriginal tradition is earlier, but that they may have slightly different time scale. But it seems to be largely around this cusp when we stop traveling around and start to have more fixed abodes. And some scholars have speculated that in these earlier times there was really no concept of spirituality. There was no concept of sacred or profane. Everything was what it was. And there was probably more of a consciousness of living in the moment, albeit that moment was very fragile and prone to violence and prone to obviously a very short lifespan. So the challenge today is to recover that, you know, some part of that earlier consciousness while living in the world that has evolved today. And some of the research on this is going on in a number of different areas. If you read the books, for instance, of Oliver Sacks, a wonderful writer on neuropsychology, he speaks a lot about these aspects, unusual aspects of human consciousness, which we sometimes only see in those whom we consider diseased in some way. But these super capabilities in people that are perhaps not so able to fit into our ordinary rush-about, cognitive, straight-ahead consumer culture consciousness, but they have incredible abilities in other areas. And so these may be, as Sacks and others have speculated, aspects of human consciousness which were more adaptive earlier in human evolution and are less adaptive now, but they carry great gifts that we could still use. We could use great gifts of intuition, sensing our relationship with each other, with animals, with nature. A lot of this would perhaps alleviate some of our problems. So all the great traditions of humanity, the great spiritual traditions, have wonderful spiritual practices that I believe if we receive the treasures from these different traditions, we will have the wisdom that we need to solve the problems that we face today. We need them all. We really need to hear all the voices as a harmony, rather than that one voice is a solo or one voice, how would we say, is the correct voice. And we need the whole harmony, each voice maintaining its own voice very clearly. So I'm going to let you go at this point. I think there's going to be a question and answer session in here as soon as our Iranian speaker has finished. And thank you all very much for your attention. We did some of these dances earlier. We may do a little bit of singing right towards the end of the conference again.